This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Over the weekend, Hawaii Public Radio discovered a fake Twitter account appearing to impersonate the authentic account belonging to the 30-meter telescope. The imposter account was posting culturally insensitive and inflammatory content appearing to originate from the TMT. HPR's reporter Ryan Finnerty broke the story and joins us now.
Good morning, Catherine. Yeah, this all happened yesterday afternoon. I was on Twitter, as many of us who are slaves to the news cycle are on the weekend, and I noticed that a prominent leader in the anti-TMT movement had retweeted a post that appeared to come from the 30-meter telescope account, which is one that I follow, so I recognize the photo and what it looks like. And it got me curious because I saw that it was one that I wasn't following, and so I wanted to take a look, and the account appeared almost identical to the normal TMT account. It was called TMT Community Outreach. It used the same photo, same banner photo, same profile photo. It had the official TMT Hawaii website listed, and it had even done things like tweet out a thank you to Governor David Ige for thanking him for his support of the project. And it had only been created in September, so this month, less than 2 weeks ago. And as I looked through the account and kind of saw some of the posts that were going out, it really started to rub me the wrong way. A lot of the content was pretty inflammatory and really culturally insensitive. A few examples, there was a photo of the character Maui from the Disney movie Moana with a caption of him speaking gibberish. There was another one that said, we being the TMT organization, we don't actually have the money to complete this project, and basically said that we're just moving forward anyway to spite opponents of the project. And that type of trolling would be pretty standard for Twitter, but this one really felt different to me because there was this effort to mirror what the actual TMT account looked like in all those different ways. And it really took, you know, some discerning reading to tell that it probably was not the real thing.
Right, someone was trying to stir the pot.
Yeah, to incite discord within the community and potentially, you know, discredit this one side of this very contentious issue in the community by making it look like they were doing things that were obviously going to incite problems. And so I reached out to the TMT spokesperson on Sunday, and he called me back shortly after and said, no, this is not an official account. We've never seen it before. They reported it to Twitter and asked that it be removed. So far, that hasn't happened. Twitter doesn't really have a very strong history of handling issues like this. The administrator of this troll account replied to me via a tweet and said that the account is satire. I personally don't agree with that characterization based on, you know, this kind of facade that he or she has created to make it look like they really are the TMT account. Since our story published yesterday, they've since modified the account, taken down the website link to the TMT, changed the photo, still using the same name, though, TMT Community Outreach, still have some of the same photos as the actual TMT page. But it does now say in the bio that it's fake. But still, if you read the name, you could still be confused, but it is less unclear than it was yesterday. And this all comes after top state leaders came out on Friday to oppose this type of online behavior, trolling, intimidation, and even violent threats that have been on the rise as this dispute has dragged on now into its third month. There was one really high-profile post that was highlighted by the Attorney General that offered a $5,000 reward for the identity of a state law enforcement officer who participated in the removal of that structure near Pu'uhuluhulu a few weeks ago, and a Hawaiian flag was cut down that created a lot of consternation online and in person. And so here was Governor David Ige. He spoke to the media on Friday, kind of condemning this type of action.
As governor of the state of Hawaii, I am calling on everyone responsible for these examples of cyberbullying and hateful speech to stop immediately. Personal attacks and threats of violence have no place in America and certainly no place here in Hawaii. for those who claim to be protecting Hawaiian values to resort to these tactics is disappointing, irresponsible, and very painful for me to see.
And Catherine, anti-TMT leader Andre Perez, who's been up on Mauna Kea throughout this entire standoff, he came to the governor's office, waited outside for reporters to leave, and then spoke to members of the media. And he separate from the governor's announcement, told everyone that the leaders of the movement disavowed those types of online tactics, those aggressive online tactics, reaffirmed their commitment to nonviolent direct action.
We're in agreement with the governor's office and with the general messaging that we do not support violent language, aggression. We do not support putting out a call for bounties. We do not support doxing and putting out public info so that people can be exposed and put at risk. We are against that.
And that term doxing, if anyone out there is not familiar with, that's when personal information, like a street address, a home address, phone number, email of an individual is released publicly over the internet, usually with the intent of stirring up trolling against them. And so that was how that was done to several law enforcement officers. The governor said that several members of the administration have received death threats. There were threatening voicemails, one that was released by the attorney general at that meeting. And so both sides have come out and taken a stand against this type of behavior. But Andre Perez, who we heard there just now, did kind of say after those remarks that these are individuals acting separately from the Protect Mauna Kea movement, that social media is uncontrollable, that was his word, and that there's no way leaders of the anti-TMT movement can control these individuals acting on social media who are not on the mountain. And so the physical confrontation is kind of at a stalemate on the Mauna Kea access road, but the disagreement seems to be heating up online.
Yeah, and with such a large movement, if you will, lots of people doing things in different ways. They have their own minds and may not follow kind of the leadership thought of making this, kapu aloha. And hard to control. We saw what happened on the freeway initially the first time with those protests. I was concerned about some road rage incidents happening.
Sure.
Out of that, but was glad to see that with the second protest or demonstration on the freeway that things worked out. They went through the channels, people were able to see the support for it, but like I said, you minimized, I think, the tension.
Yeah, and as you know, I was on Mauna Kea for the first week of the protest, and what I saw consistently was a very diligent effort by protest leaders to prevent any type of violence or physical confrontation. They removed people from their own ranks who were kind of getting a little bit too close to that line. But as Andre Perez said in his statements, they can really only control what happens on the mountain. They can't control what happens online, and nor, it seems, can authorities. And so that was kind of why we saw that appeal from the governor and other leaders to stop this.
And while you were at that news conference on Friday, someone posted something on social media which got the attention of the FBI.
Yeah, that's right. It was reported by the Star Advertiser on Saturday, the Honolulu Star Advertiser, that the FBI had issued a bulletin to state and local law enforcement about a potential mass shooting at the state capitol, threat that was posted in the comment section of the governor's press conference. That obviously didn't happen, thankfully. State Attorney General Claire Connors said they were aware of it and were monitoring it, but no arrests have been made.
Right. I think the bottom line is people will need to understand that, the FBI gets involved. Very serious threats, or
yeah,
they're going to be investigating.
There's real-world consequences to online behavior.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Sure.
That was HPR's Ryan Finnerty talking about this latest flap on the Mauna Kea situation.
Thank you. sustaining membership, it just makes sense. Hawaii Public Radio is an anchor for my day, and I want to contribute to something that is so much part of my day and my life. It's easy. I don't have to think about it. It's far less expensive than a cable bill or even a coffee every day. So why wouldn't I be a sustaining member? My name is Marie Rose, and I'm a sustaining member of Hawaii Public Radio.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's backyard quiz, we take a look at a pioneering Hawaii-born Chinese-American athlete. Walter Achiu was born in Honolulu just after the turn of the century in 1902. The phonetic pronunciation of his last name earned him the nickname Sneeze, a moniker which followed him into his pro football career. A graduate of both Kamehameha Schools and St. Louis School, Achiu's athletic prowess led him to an accomplished career at the University of Dayton in Ohio. There, he was a three-sport athlete, excelling in football, baseball, and track as the team captain. While Achiu was a gifted athlete in these different sports, it was his ascension in American professional football which earned him the most fame. 20 years before Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in professional baseball, Walter Achiu became the first person of East Asian descent to play pro football, as well as the first person of an ethnic minority to play professional sports in the United States. His professional career was short, however, as he only played a single season in the National Football League from 1927 to 1928. Now for today's backyard quiz, what team did Walter Sneeze Achiu play on? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bishop Museum's Spineless Wonders, Rising from the Deep, an exploration of marine invertebrates and their deep-sea environment. Opens September 21st. BishopMuseum.org.
Who wants to get protected? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk with a pediatric expert about the vaccination schedule for kids and young adults, why it's important to get immunizations, and what infections can be avoided. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
This week, close to 1,500 marine scientists and oceanographers are gathering at the Hawaii Convention Center. The Ocean Obs Conference, short for Ocean Observation, is held every 10 years, and this is the first time it's been held in the Pacific. We talked to Christopher Sabine, the interim associate dean of the School of Oceanography at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, about what's in store.
This is a meeting that we have every 10 years. We get all of the people that make measurements in the ocean, large-scale, global-type measurements in the ocean together to discuss what we're learning and strategize for what are we going to do over the next 10 years. And it started off, the first meeting was in 1999 in France, and it was primarily just people that are making physical measurements of the temperature and the salt content of the ocean. And that was such a success that 10 years later, in 2009, when we met in Italy, we incorporated the chemists like myself that do chemical measurements in the ocean. Now we're hoping to include the biological community and really tie in those that make measurements in the coastal regions. This is a group that's measuring, making measurements globally. So they're measuring parameters all over the oceans. But yes, there are quite a few differences between the Atlantic and the Pacific. The Atlantic is warmer than the Pacific. It's more salty than the Pacific. And of course, the Pacific is significantly larger than the Atlantic. And one of the consequences, one of the unique aspects of this meeting is that the past two meetings being in Europe had more of an Atlantic focus to them, just because the most of the participants were from that local region. Now that we're in the Pacific, we've got a much larger contingent of people participating from Asia, from the Pacific Islands, from all around the Pacific Rim. So I think there'll be a more of a Pacific flavor, a Pacific focus for this particular workshop. The University of Hawaii and the School of Ocean Earth Science and Technology is very proud to be an active participant in contributing to this workshop and helping to organize it. And we do that because many of our researchers and scientists and professors do contribute to this overall observation program that we're discussing. So, for example, there's the Hawaii Ocean Time Series, where we take a ship out north of Oahu every month to go and make measurements throughout the water column. Those tie in very closely to the atmospheric observations that are made on Mauna Loa, have been since 1958, that have documented the rise in atmospheric CO2. We're doing the same thing, trying to document the increase in CO2 in the oceans as well as other parameters. The PACIUS, the Pacific Integrated Ocean Observing System, is housed at UH, and that's another program that's directly linked to this workshop, where they make measurements of, for example, waves. So all the surfers out there, they're likely going and getting information from the PACIUS wave buoys to figure out whether the surf's up or not.
I love that website because they have all of Carl Meyer's shark tracking research on there, and that's just fascinating for anyone that's in the ocean. And then also, they've got this wonderful animation of where the water from the Alawai Canal, where it goes through Waikiki, you know, based on the currents. I mean, it's really eye-opening.
Exactly. That's been one of the premier projects that the university has been promoting here locally, is this Alawai, Smart Alawai study, where we're instrumenting the rivers that flow into the Alawai, monitoring what's happening in the Alawai, and then even offshore, looking at the impact that has on Waikiki Beach and the waters surrounding. And that really ties in nicely to a theme of the workshop, where historically, the measurements we've made have been focused on the blue water, the open ocean measurements. But a lot of the connection that humans have to our oceans is in the coastal region, right? We go to the beach or we do our fishing pretty close to shore. So this workshop is really focusing on what measurements can we make in the coastal region, like understanding the Alawai outflow, to better understand the impacts that some of these global scale phenomena like climate change are having on our local economy and our local ecosystems and our local society. One of the key tenets of what we're doing is we're trying to document changes over decades. And you don't want to change what your approach to this, you know, willy-nilly every couple of years or whatever. So we have these meetings once a decade, and we plan out at these workshops. We spend a week going through what we've learned from the past decade and looking at where we want to go in the next decade. And it's kind of like a big ship. You know, you don't just turn it quickly. So we slowly evolve the measurements that we're making so that we can then tie all this together and know that the measurements we were making 20, 30 years ago, the Hawaii Ocean Time Series program is in its 30th year now. We want to know that what the measurements we made back in the 1990s are still relevant and can be directly compared to the measurements that we're making in the 2020s or the 2030s or the 2040s.
And so I know I've done stories on things like the Aloha Observatory. Mm-hmm. Explain to our listeners what that project does.
Right. So there's a time series site that's 100 kilometers north of Oahu, where we take a ship out every month to measure a whole bunch of different things: the temperature, the salinity, the chemistry, the biology. And we can document over time, we've been doing this now for 30 years, we can document over time how the oceans are changing as the environment, as the climate changes, as CO2 increases. My particular area of study is looking at the uptake of fossil fuel CO2 into the ocean and the impact that's having on the organisms through something we call ocean acidification that's affecting the coral reefs, but it's also changing out in the open oceans. And through this Station Aloha, we've been able to document those changes.
I've heard lots of stories about acid rain and how it affects things on the land. Your research then is in the ocean and on the organisms.
Right. So acid rain predominantly came from sulfur that was in coal. So when you had coal power plants, it releases sulfur into the atmosphere. The sulfur reacts with the water to form sulfuric acid that rains down and obviously is bad for the plants. But sulfur gases have a very short lifetime in the history, in the atmosphere. So those gases really only affected the area just downwind of the power plants. Carbon dioxide, on the other hand, it's also an acid gas. CO2 reacts with water to form carbonic acid, but CO2 is a very long-lived, it stays in the atmosphere for thousands of years. So CO2 that's emitted in the Midwest or in Russia or in China or Europe ends up circulating around the entire Earth, and it affects us here in Hawaii as well as all around the globe. So it's a little bit different from the acid rain and requires these global type measurements like we'll be discussing at this workshop. You can't just measure it just downstream of the power plant. The oceans are very remote, so it's expensive to get out and make these measurements. So we're looking at ways that we can improve our technologies to make these observations. What new observations might we want to make? How can we perhaps make them using autonomous vehicles? So, for example, there's some new technologies coming online with, like, for example, a remote sailboat that we can instrument with a bunch of different sensors, and we can have it sail around the oceans for a year at a time, collecting measurements and sending them back via satellite. That's much safer than sending people out to sea where they could, you know, get in trouble. And it allows us to sample in storms and things that we wouldn't normally want to sample in if we had people on board ships. And it's less expensive because it's a sail-powered drone that, you know, doesn't require, we don't have to pay it a salary. It just goes. One thing I did want to highlight is, so as part of this workshop we do every 10 years, we're putting out a conference statement. And in this statement, which I think is particularly important this around this time, is that we are promoting and trying to highlight the importance of ocean observations and collecting data on the oceans. You know, there's a trend now to devalue the importance of science, and we really want to promote and re-emphasize the importance of actually backing up science and our predictions with real observations. So we have a conference statement just reiterating the importance of the scientific measurements we're making, and you can go on to the conference website, which is oceanobs19.net, and take a look at that conference statement and provide input on that or endorse it or at least get an understanding of where we're coming from as a scientific community in a world that's perhaps looking at alternative facts and not valuing science so much. We want to try and highlight that.
Is this the first time you folks have had this statement?
We've had statements in the past in our previous meetings, but this one really is, I think, more important because we are highlighting, in particular, the value of scientific observations as opposed to focusing more on which observations we're making. This one really is focused a little more on the broader audience and trying to convey that message as a group of 1,400 scientists, and we've got input from scientists from 63 different countries, and there's also a whole group of community white papers that were written from this, so we're actually getting input from many, many thousands, as much as 10,000 scientists from around the world that are contributing to this effort, even if they're not coming to Hawaii this week.
Okay, so solid data and scientists standing behind it.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Christopher Sabine, Interim Associate Dean of the School of Oceanography at UH Manoa. He previously worked in Seattle and also worked as a researcher with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii, located in the outrigger Waikiki, presenting smooth jazz artist Keiko Matsui, performing in two sets nightly, this Friday through Sunday. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Anti-immigrant politicians depict the Statue of Liberty not as mother of exiles, but as a guardian, shielding America from the teeming hordes.
I mean, it is a sign of how powerful she is in public life that they feel like they just have to wrestle with her, and she keeps fighting back.
Brooke visits with Lady Liberty on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Tonight at 7, following The Body Show.
Need your poke fix? Well, I went looking for fresh ahi poke at three places last month and was surprised no one had any. What's up with that? Our reality check with Honolulu Civil Beat's Nathan Eagle could give us an answer. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, I went to a place right across from your Kaimuki offices, and I was told that not only did they not have fresh ahi, they hadn't had it all week, and they probably wouldn't have it till Wednesday. So I was really kind of surprised about that.
I know. How do we survive without our fresh poke?
Yes. So I went without.
And I've become so good. That's been my move of late, too. I've gotten too used to having really good, really fresh ahi poke, and that if it's not fresh, I don't want it.
Yeah, so you have an article about climate change.
Yeah, absolutely. Not the best news on the ahi front, particularly big eye tuna. The scientists are telling me that they're going to be smaller, less abundant, and farther away, which could mean it'd be more expensive for our fishermen to travel to find them, and they may come back with less, which at the end of the day could mean pricier ahi poke bowls and sashimi plates for us.
Yeah, or you just go without like I did.
Or you just go without.
Yeah, you have to wait till the ship comes in, really. That's what it is that they don't come in until they've got their catch.
Absolutely. And yeah, and with the ocean heating up, you know, that's changing where they're at in the ocean and basically where their prey is at. And so they're going farther towards the poles and away from the tropics and also farther east.
Right. So if they have to go farther, it's going to take a while before they come in with that fresh fish.
It really is.
So what else are you looking at in regard to this climate change and how our fishermen find their catch?
Well, there was one thing that was interesting in one of the lead scientists I talked to on a relatively recent study, I think it just came out this summer, Phoebe Woodworth Jeffcoats. She found in her modeling that just with about 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit global warming, which isn't too much, the catch will fall about 25%, and so will the overall biomass. But what is really fascinating is that if the fishermen would gradually fish less, about half as hard over time, the same loss in catch will be about the same, but the biomass will actually skyrocket about 44%, which is good for the whole marine ecosystem and, of course, all the tunas for us.
Yeah, but, you know, you're right about the warming. I mean, I went swimming yesterday, and the water was icky hot. And, you know, another swimmer and I just lamented, like, ew, you know, is this going to be the norm from now on, or at least maybe through the next month or so?
I mean, all signs indicate that, yes, the ocean is just going to continue to heat up, which, of course, is not only just making it feel less refreshing than maybe it was. Maybe it'll get cooler towards the winter, but then gradually still warmer over time. But then that's also creating less healthy corals, you know, bleaching and stuff, and signs like that are already coming out. The summer's not looking like it's going to be a good one for corals. And then when you, of course, play that up the ecosystem and talk about all the fish that those corals support and then that the tuna eat, more bad news on that front.
Yeah, I mean, I can get out of the water when I'm too hot, but the fish, that's where they live.
Exactly. Yeah. So the tunas are bigger. They can dive deeper and deeper in search of all their food. But others, you know, they have very limited areas where they can be and they can thrive.
And you also looked at not just, you know, around Hawaii, but throughout the Pacific, right? You looked at the Northern Marianas and what they were seeing out there.
Yeah, I did a little bit. And it's a similar story. They're just the migration patterns are sometimes a little different.
And so what are fishermen to do? How do we deal with this?
Well, one of the solutions coming from one of the guys I interviewed, Dave Gershman over at the Ocean Foundation, he says that the focus needs to be on better international agreements to develop long-term harvest strategies. So the commission that would handle all that has already indicated that they want to do that, but we're still in the process of them actually hammering that out. Their next big meeting is in December, so we'll be watching that. But basically, it's to take a less reactive approach and try to be a lot more proactive instead of what they're doing now, which is basically negotiating every year how much tuna can be caught the next year.
And you folks are focusing a lot of your effort on climate change. You're going to be doing more of this reporting.
Yeah, absolutely. We're part of the Covering Climate Now initiative. That's 200-some media organizations around the globe, primarily in the U.S. They're reaching an audience of about 1 billion people. So the goal is this really intense week of climate coverage. And so for us, we kicked it off this week, but there will be more stories the rest of the week. We're going to launch another podcast and just kind of really stay on top of this issue as best we can.
And on your website, you've got a kind of a questionnaire for your readers to kind of take part in.
Yeah, my colleague Claire will be working on a podcast where she wants to hear from readers. What are your questions? And then she'll research answers and put together a podcast that hopefully addresses them.
Okay. And I know we just did a mention on the Ocean Observation Conference that's going on across the street. Are you going to head over there later this day?
It wouldn't surprise me if I'm there.
Okay. All right. Well, we appreciate you staying on top of this, and then we'll just see where it goes, and we'll look forward to the next climate change feature on the website.
Sounds great. Thanks.
All right. Thanks so much. That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's Reality Check. To read his story on this issue, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Diamond Head Theater. In the musical Kinky Boots, a factory owner partners with a drag queen to save the family business. Opens this Friday. DiamondHeadTheater.com.
Last week, we told you about the city's outreach navigation program, the latest outreach to help the mentally ill living on Honolulu streets. Bob wrote in to our talkback line to share his thoughts. He says, I'm very interested in this topic and Senate Bill 1164, authored by Carl Rhodes. The bottom line is this. You don't have any civil rights if you're mentally incapable of helping yourself, so this development is vital to solving 50% of Oahu's homeless problems. My concern, the rollout so far is so slow. I hear they've only intervened in 4 cases so far. And following our show with Hawaiian Electric Company and Ulupono Initiative about raising rates for green energy, we received a few comments on the talkback line.
Hi, my name is Just Tom. I'm from Pahoa. I'm curious about this storage situation. People talking about buying lithium batteries. You've got to throw those away every couple of 3 years. In New England, has a lot of surplus power during the day, so they use a water storage system. They pump water from the river into a elevated reservoir. When they need the power, the water comes down the reservoir. But in Hilo here, just in the west side of town, we've got a really wet spot. If we put a reservoir up there and put the hydro down below, that seems like a good storage media.
My name is Mark DeMoss. My comment was just that with the Hawaiian telecom investment and with Helco trying to make up for previous bad investments. They're raising rates unreasonably, and the public would just be better off doing their own research and really going out to do their own solar privately and individually, with the exception of maybe a hospital or a school.
Yeah, my name is Mike Last. I live at the south point of Big Island, and my comments has to do with the program about Helco or HECO and on Friday. As a residential ratepayer, I see that since December, my electric rate, not my bill, my rate has gone down 13%. That's residential. For the commercial side of the business, under the G rate, it has gone down 12%, the J rate, 14%, and the P rate, 16%. Now, I am not employed or affiliated with any way with Helco, except once a month I receive a bill, once a month I remit to the payment for the bill. So I do want to say it's very unusual that that people complain about the electric company when there's no other option. That's incorrect. They can always get off the grid.
Thanks for that feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and also things we can try and spot in dark skies above. As usual, we're turning to the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips and welcoming him back right now. Hey, Chris, what do you have this week? Welcome back.
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers look out for Jupiter and Saturn in the evening sky. Both planets can be seen in the south after sunset, and both are very bright. The moon this week is beginning to wane, but will remain a bright presence in the night sky through week's end.
There's been some news about yet another interstellar visitor arriving in our solar system, and you have more on that?
Yes, the Gemini North Observatory has captured an image of the first interstellar comet to be observed. This visitor from another solar system is currently on course to whip around the sun and come within 2 astronomical units of the Earth. And for those of you that are curious, an astronomical unit is the distance between the Earth and the Sun, so about 92 million miles.
Tell us a little bit about the Gemini Observatory capturing the image.
Well, the team used the Gemini Multi-Object Spectrograph, which had to be on target very quickly since the comet appears in the general direction of the Sun, and so these images had to be taken in the twilight just before sunrise.
There's also been another visitor from outside the solar system and with a very strong connection to the state.
That's true. In 2017, an object we now know as Oumuamua was observed by Pan-STARRS. However, Oumuamua had no tail or visible outgassing, and so we believe it to be a rocky fragment. This new object, currently known with the catchy name of C2017Q4, is most definitely a comet because we can see a tail composed of visible gases and dust.
And how big is this thing?
We don't really have a specific size right now, but the more measurements we take over the next few months will help us pin down its size.
And it's not having a multicolored tail like the thing you were recently talking about.
No, this is completely different. This tail is composed of ices, which are sublimating off the surface of the object.
We still like it. It's a good tail with us. And on a more serious note, is this thing going to stick around, or is it headed back out into space?
Well, the trajectory of this comet suggests that it's going to pass right through the solar system, so it's very important we get as many observations as we can, because it's going to go back out into space, never to be seen again.
And we know if we learn more about it, we'll hear about it here on Stargazer with you, Christopher Phillips. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for Kohala High School STEM and Science Facility on Hawaii Island, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we put the spotlight on a trailblazing Asian American athlete born in Hawaii during the island's territorial days. Walter Achu, known by his nickname Sneeze, was the first person of East Asian descent to play football professionally and was among the first of an ethnic minority to play professional sports in the United States. An alumnus of Kamehameha Schools and St. Louis School, Achu's athletic prowess as a three-sport athlete at the University of Dayton earned him a place in the school's Athletic Hall of Fame in 1974. It also earned him a roster spot as a running back and defensive back on the now-defunct Dayton Triangles, which is also the answer to today's quiz. While Achu's career was groundbreaking for minorities in American football, it only lasted 1 year. Of his skill on the field, the Dayton Herald once wrote, "Achu is a speed demon, a hard man to stop, and a splendid interferer." This should come as no surprise, given that Achu found a career after football as a professional wrestler. We stumped you on that one, but shame on you. St. Louis Crusaders, you should have known that one. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's Disaster Preparedness Month, and we're looking at how prepared we are with food and supplies for when a hurricane or other natural disaster strikes. How does a neighbor island, how do they get their supplies during an emergency? Well, we talked to Keith Kiyotaki, the sales and marketing manager at Inner Island Shipper Young Brothers, about how they prepare their equipment and personnel prior to disaster and getting those goods flowing after the storm passes.
At Young Brothers, you know, we have a number, we're regulated by the PUC. So we do have 12 regulated sailings to the neighbor islands. And what happens is when any time a hurricane comes, it throws our schedule off, you know, because what we're concerned is mainly getting goods to the neighbor islands. And then once the storm has passed, to make sure that there's a continuing flow of goods to the neighbor island. So anytime a storm approaches, the neighbor island stores are preparing themselves by stocking themselves. There's going to be a run on water, a run on rice, a run on toilet paper. So as your only inter-island shipper, Young Brothers gets the cargo to the neighbor islands, and then we try to get out of the ports before the storm or the Coast Guard actually closes the port.
Yes, and I got kind of a slice of life because I happened to be in Halaba Valley when I think the FEMA crews were preparing some of the goods, you know, water and those types of things, and they were getting them out of the warehouses, putting them on flatbed trucks to get them down to the docks for you folks to send over.
Yeah, and in fact, and it's interesting you say that because Eric, which was at the end of July, beginning of August, we were in constant contact with FEMA in Washington, D.C., as well as the FEMA in Halaba Valley. So before Hurricane Eric was approaching the islands, we basically shipped a total of 9 containers, 40-foot containers, filled with water, filled with cots, filled with supplies. You know, 3 went to Kauai, 3 went to the Big Island, and 3 went to Maui, you know. Very good, because it's there. It's sitting on the island right now. In the event that a hurricane does hit one of those islands, the supplies are ready to go ahead and to be distributed. So we're a little bit ahead of the game, you know, and that's the whole thing, is being prepared for a storm that's approaching.
Right, so at least we've been able to stage these things in advance. We still have a couple of more months left in hurricane season, so that's a little bit of assurance that there are goods there.
Yes, and you know, as it says, those goods are ready to roll once if a catastrophe does hit the island. Once the ports are reopened and customers and truckers can get down to our facility, those containers, those three containers on each island, are ready to roll and supply the community.
And we saw what happened with Iniki when Kauai was devastated, and the rebuilding that had to go on after that. And so that means bringing over a lot of the construction material.
That's correct. And we brought a whole bunch of material. And we also, because a lot of the electricity was down, we ended up cashing our employees' check and giving them money so they can go ahead and use it at the stores to buy their own, you know, the needs that, you know, to help them get going. But, yeah, you know, once a hurricane hits, we're ready to react. You know, we'll work with a lot of the state agencies, the county agencies. We'll work with the power companies. We'll work with the electric companies, gas companies. And what we'll do is we'll prioritize their shipment to get onto the barge so the infrastructure is there to go ahead and start moving goods, get electricity back to the community, get the phone system working.
Okay, and then you mentioned the whole port closure thing, and that's a decision by, I think, the U.S. Coast Guard when they determine that, you know, there's a real threat, and they either advise mariners to leave or stay put and hunker down.
That's correct. You know, once a hurricane is approaching the islands, we have our security safety team huddled up. We're in conversations with the Department of Transportation, Harbor Division, with the Coast Guard, and we're basically going to base on their advice, whether, okay, the approaching storm is within 48 hours, we're going to have to close down the port at XX time. And then from there, once the port is closed, then everything is hunkered down. So once the port, prior to the port is closing, we want to make sure, number one, our employees and our mariners are safe. That's the real important thing. So, you know, everybody before a storm needs to be prepared. The second thing is we want to make sure that we're doing our proper things and making sure that there is no hazardous cargo that can go into the water. And then the third thing what we do is we secure things either at the port or we'll throw things onto the barges. When I say throw things on our barge, we'll move our heavy equipment, forklifts, fuel, and we'll send our barges. And we have a total of seven barges. We'll send them all out to sea with our heavy equipment. Once the Coast Guard, the Department of Transportation, Harbors, clears the waterways, we come in back to the home port, start unloading all our forklifts, all the fuel, all our ramps, and then from there we can go ahead and start taking goods to the neighbor island once again.
You know, I think we've been watching some of the images on the news about that big vessel that overturned. They were able to rescue I think it was South Korean crew members, but you know, you just never know what's going to happen. And Young Brothers has been pretty fortunate with their barges.
Yes, we've had. You know, our sister company had a tragedy 2-3 years ago with an El Faro. Got in the hurricane, I believe it was in the Puerto Rico area. And there was about 30 people that lost their lives from our sister company, Tote. And, you know, and that's where we as a company always puts our mariners, ours put our shoreside people, that's important. We want to make sure that they go back to their families at the end of the day. You know, our business as a whole is very, very heavy machine operated, you know, so at any time someone can get hurt. But yeah, a very, very unfortunate situation when anybody in the maritime industry loses a life. And loses a vessel.
Right, but fortunately here in Hawaii, we've been safe.
Correct, we have been safe, you know, and, you know, with the approaching storms, I think the state of Hawaii, you know, FEMA, you know, the everybody does an excellent job of preparing everybody from there. But as a whole, we need to be prepared ourselves. You know, we need to make sure that we have our home supplies ready in the event that you need to evacuate your home.
Right, and it used to be just a few days. Now they're saying a couple of weeks or more.
14 days, they says you need, you know, supplies and water. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, there are things that you need you don't think of. They said to bring matches, you know, to bring mosquito repellent, because if power is out, you got stagnant water around, then you got to be prepared for, like, your camping out there. We take it for granted that, you know, it's steady business for us. We're sailing today, arriving to the neighbor island the next day. But we're always watching for the weather to make sure that it's not going to impact not only, as it says, our mariners, but also the community. But we're ready to react. You know, we're prepared before a storm, and we're ready to react as soon as the storm impacts the island, and we're ready to get cargo flowing to make sure the community is back on its feet.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Keith Yutaki, Sales and Marketing Manager with Inter-Island Shipper Young Brothers, talking about Disaster Preparedness Month.
I'm Pia Arma. I'm the founder and principal of Pineapple Tweed Public Relations and Marketing, and I am an underwriter and contributor to Hawaii Public Radio. Underwriting programs in Hawaii Public Radio pretty much ensures that you reach the people that are thoughtful and innovative leaders in the community. So I chose to be an underwriter because I am reaching the thoughtful and innovative leaders in the community that I want to reach.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here.
We are out of time today. Tomorrow, we bring back voices of lay sellers who work to keep a cultural tradition alive. We look at the history and peer into what some worry could be a fragile future for flowers. We'd like to hear from you. Call or talk back line. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or tweet us at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.